militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me today. If you are new to the podcast, welcome. I know that some of you may have seen me on Fox News last night, Jesse Waters' program. Thanks very much to Charlie for the invite, and welcome to the podcast. We do talk about Second Amendment news and information. It's not always Virginia specific. I know I was talking about Virginia last night, but we do cover all of the news from around the country related to your right to keep and bear arms. And in fact, we're going to be talking about a national story today, as well as a local story out of California with Costas Morris from the Second Amendment Foundation is going to join us. Costas also getting ready to participate in what should be a really fascinating debate over what the right to bear arms actually means. Is it the right to bear arms only openly? Is it the right to bear arms openly or concealed? And that should be a fascinating discussion. Costas is going to detail the upcoming debate when he joins us here. In fact, let's go ahead and get started. It's a great conversation. Always appreciate Costas spending some time with us. Take a look and a listen. Costas, thanks so much for joining me on the program. It's good to see you again.
Always a pleasure, Cam. Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, and there's some good news to discuss. Not at the Supreme Court, although hopefully we'll get some of that on Monday. But I thought this was really good news. Judge Reed O'Connor has denied the DOJ's request to essentially limit an injunction. This is a case dealing with the federal ban on firearms in postal facilities, right?
Yes. So just so if your viewers don't recall, we won an injunction from in the district court on that case. But what happened afterwards was that the DOJ tried to limit it to, because remember, we base it on an associational standing. And in this era, judges like to limit rulings to the associations, and they don't issue nationwide injunctions anymore, according to the Supreme Court. So the judge had limited to members of SAF and FPC. But the federal government argued it should be limited not only to members of SAF and FPC, but members of SAF and FPC who were members when the lawsuit was first filed, not so future members would not get any relief. And we'd have to either, you know, file for a new injunction or file a class action lawsuit to get wider relief. So we fought them on that in a rare instance of us. There's also the NFA cases, I guess, but in a rare instance of us disagreeing with the administration, and we won. I think that's what you were getting to. So Judge O'Connor ruled yesterday that no, there's no precedent for limiting injunctions in this way. And by the way, on their side of things, it would be a huge burden on the courts, which it would be if, you know, they kept having to re-rule on injunctions to widen the effect of it. So he said current and future SAF members are covered. When I say future, of course, I mean you still have to be a member. You can't just say you're going to be one. But yeah.
Right. Yeah. But yeah. those members who join in the future.
Yes.
Or who
yes.
join after this lawsuit was filed. And I know that the DOJ has appealed this up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Fifth Circuit denied to stay that injunction. Mm-hmm. So does that mean, Costas, that as a member of the Second Amendment Foundation or the Firearms Policy Coalition, I can lawfully carry into a post office today?
Yes. Yeah, that is what that means. We do caution that if there's a separate reason you can't carry at that post office, the example we gave on Twitter was if the post office is on a military base, for example, then you're not magically covered just because it's a post office. But if there's no other reason you can't carry at that post office besides the federal law, then yeah, you can now carry as long as you're a SAF or FPC member.
That is fantastic to hear. You know, and a question about that associational standing. This was not, by the way, I don't think the DOJ specifically going after FPC and SAF saying, we don't want you guys to be able to, have this expanded. They really are doing this in virtually every case, right? Trying to limit the scope of these injunctions based on the CASA ruling. So how do we get a law actually overturned? Because, in this case, we've got a judge that says, yes, the law is unconstitutional, but this was an as-applied challenge to the members of SAF and FPC. So how does something like this actually get stricken from the books if we don't have nationwide injunctions? Does it take a class action lawsuit?
Well, remember, no laws actually never get stricken from the books until Congress repeals them. All courts say is you can't enforce them. So what has happened here is that a judge said the law is unconstitutional and DOJ is going to appeal and we're going to fight it out on appeal. What we're hearing from DOJ and what the historical practice has been is even if the injunction is limited, once we have a final ruling, all appeals exhausted, let's say we win at the end, but the win is limited to SAF and FPC members, the federal government and governments in general generally stop enforcing it against everyone. And the reason they do that is because once you have a final unappealable ruling, if you try and enforce that against somebody else, you are liable for qualified immunity doesn't apply because it's a clearly established right. So anybody who is enforcing that is now subject to personal liability and damages. So in practice, legal fiction about, oh, it's only limited to association members, that's while the case is pending. But once you have a final unappealable judgment, whether it goes to the Supreme Court, Fifth Circuit, then it's done. You know, then they won't enforce it against anyone is what I'm trying to say.
Okay. Yeah. That is very good to hear. And thanks for the clarification because I've been wondering about that. So speaking of appeals, this brings us to our next topic. And this would be California's continued appeal of the losses that they've taken over the law that was passed that essentially limited the speech of anybody within the firearm space, right? That could be deemed to be marketing products or even, you know, marketing the idea that shooting is fun to minors, right? This was a law that California passed. I think folks are probably aware of the aftermath of this. You know, you had youth shooting leagues in the state had to shut down because sponsors were afraid that they could be, you know, subject to fines if they were sponsoring a junior shooting team. You had Junior Shooters Magazine that was, you know, afraid it would be fined for publishing this magazine and making it available in California. California did lose at both the district court level and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, correct?
Yeah. So this law started because Gavin Newsom threw a temper tantrum about the JR-15, which was a 22 rifle that looked like an AR-15. And he talked about marketing to kids, but an adult still had to buy the gun, obviously.
Right.
You know, children can't buy the gun. So what they wrote this law so broadly that anything that could be read as appealing to minors in the firearm space was banned. So, you know, SAF, joined by my old friends at CRPA, filed this lawsuit. Our attorney, Don Kilmer, and my old excellent colleague, Anna Barvier, brought this, and they won in the district court, and then they won in the Ninth Circuit. And then California made this harebrained argument that, oh, well, the Ninth Circuit only meant to enjoin part of this law, not the whole law. And I won't get into the details of what that was because it's kind of in the weeds. But okay. So we went back to the district court. The district court, which hates us, actually went with that. And they said, yep, we're going to limit this. And so we had to appeal again. And the Ninth Circuit said, no, we meant it, the whole law. And then we won. And remember, after the first time, California sought en banc review because we did get a favorable 3-judge panel. And nobody voted to take it, not even on the liberal Ninth Circuit. So I think they forgot that this is a First Amendment case and not a Second Amendment case. And the Ninth Circuit still has some principles when it comes to the First Amendment, you know, so they got their clocks cleaned. And yesterday we announced that we reached a settlement, which the judge has now signed off on. And California is going to pay a combined, to our case, $900,000 split between SAF and the other plaintiffs. And then in the parallel case, because there was also a separate case on the same issue, mm-hmm. another $400,000 or so. I think it's $380,000, something like that. So California, this whole stunt has cost California about $1.4 million. And they could have even lessened that had they not taken the second appeal, but, you know, they really maxed it out. And by the way, that amount is only for our side. I don't know what they paid in salaries and all that for their lawyers, right?
Right. So. Yeah. These are the attorney's fees for the plaintiffs.
Right.
And, you know, listen, I mean, it's $1.4 million. I'm sure that there are a bunch of, you know, paper pushers in Sacramento say, this is a rounding error. I would just note that California already has a multi-billion-dollar budget deficit, so they really can't afford to be wasting any money at all at this point, much less over $1 million here. So Congratulations.
Yeah, that's exactly true. A bunch of gun control bills. You know, we're always passing gun control in California, but a bunch of them did fail last year that otherwise normally would pass because of budget concerns. The legislators now actually a little bit scared of this issue. So, yeah, it's $1.4 million in the context of California isn't a lot, but they just torched over $1 million at a time when they don't have that money. So,
right.
You know, bad idea.
Yeah. And speaking of the Ninth Circuit, I did note you had talked about this earlier in the week, a couple of cases that I think are going on bonk in the Ninth Circuit seems to have drawn in one case, it looks like a pretty favorable panel of judges. The other, at least not outright, a bad panel. Ninth Circuit's a little bit different because of how many judges are on the Ninth Circuit. An en banc review in every other circuit involves every judge on the circuit. But in the Ninth Circuit, it's basically a random draw because I think there were, 27 judges there.
Yeah, 29.
Okay. So this is Rhodey versus Bonner, right? That's the ammo background check. The can't purchase ammo out of state and bring it back into California. Can't purchase ammo online without violating the law. That's the case that has what, like 8 Republican appointed judges. And
yeah, but I don't want to hype people up with the 8 Republican judges because I did the math based on voting history, not just party history in Second Amendment cases. So where we're at, based on my calculations, is 5 solidly against us, 4 solidly for us, and 2 toss ups. So it's winnable. Okay. It's winnable. And in the Ninth Circuit, when you're in the game, you're doing well. And then the other case, Yukitaki, which is the Hawaii weird background check where you have to bring your gun back within 5 days to be inspected by police after you buy it every time. It's insanity. That one is a 5-5 with one swing judge who's a Democrat, but the swing judge is the guy, Judge Owens, who sided with us on the 1-in-30 case. Remember, California had that limit where you can only buy one gun in 30. So he's shown in the past that he's willing to be reasonable. Maybe he wouldn't be with us in an assault weapons case, but in a crazy background check, maybe he'll side with us. So that one's a total toss-up as far as I see it. So yes, it's great. In the Ninth Circuit, we have 2 toss-up cases next week going on bonk. So we're in pretty good position, historically speaking, because usually we go into these knowing we're going to lose. And for once, we could win, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm hopeful listen, I'd love to see both cases, both laws overturned. But, you know, especially Yukitaki, that seems like such an aberration. I mean, such an outlier gun law. What's the national tradition?
You know, when Yukitaki got its 3-judge panel ruling and the law was struck down, I was too optimistic, but I was saying at the time, you know, the Ninth Circuit's been getting all this criticism about all the en bonks. I bet you they won't en banc this one just as a token to say, see, we don't overturn everything because it's such a silly law, you know, who cares? But nope, they proved me wrong and they took it en banc. Maybe it's more about the analysis in the case. I don't know. But yeah, so we'll see what happens. I hope that the Ninth Circuit learns its lesson because this is always a risk. The Ninth Circuit is liberal leaning, anti-gun leaning, but there are enough conservative judges there now where this is a risk for them. When they en banc everything, sometimes we might get lucky on a roll because it's 11 out of 29. Now, again, not to get too in the weeds, but there is a thing called a super en banc where all 29 judges could rehear a case. That's never happened before in the Ninth Circuit's history, as far as I know. Definitely not in a gun case. But there's a first time for everything, and maybe they'll prove just how far they're willing to go. Oh, you know,
don't even give them that idea. is Judge Lawrence Van Dyke on either one of these panels?
He's on both of them. I don't know how we got so lucky, but yes, he's on both of them.
I just can't wait to hear what he has to say.
we're always excited to hear what Judge Van Dyke has to say.
Absolutely. I'm also excited to hear what you have to say. This is going to be really interesting. This is going to happen on X, right? You are debating Charles Nichols about the scope of the right to bear arms historically.
Yes.
And for folks who don't know who Charles Nichols is, can you give us a little bit of a background?
Well, he's a very pleasant fellow that loves to have polite conversations. Now, Charles Nichols is he's an open carry advocate. He's been litigating this issue for like 15 years now in California. Nichols v. Newsom, I think it's called now. I forget. But and he's extremely knowledgeable, but he has a sort of abrasive personality, to put it lightly. He thinks that anyone who concealed carry is, and I quote, criminal degenerate or something like that. Like he does not agree with concealed carry. He thinks it's immoral and he thinks open carry is the only way to go. That said, you know, a lot of people, when he goes on Twitter and calls them names like that, get really angry and fight with him, and he blocks them. When he called me that, I was mostly curious, because what makes me angry on Twitter and what fires me up is when someone's arguing in bad faith. They don't actually believe what they're saying. But he actually believes what he's saying. So my reaction wasn't anger. It was like, wow, why do you think that? That's kind of nuts. You know, I want to learn more. And getting to know him, he is an extremely knowledgeable person. I don't think anybody out there knows more about the history of especially Supreme Court Second Amendment cases. Like, he's always, every week he updates his list of cases at the Supreme Court. He's a wealth of knowledge. So I'm very interested in speaking more with him about this. I think we actually agree with more than we disagree on. I think I agree with him on the history of open carry and how concealed carry was historically restricted. So open carry was the intended right. But where we disagree, of course, is whether it's moral or not. I would say, you know, you don't owe a duty to any criminal, you know, to tell them you're carrying, especially if you're not attacking anyone. They would have to attack you to even find out that you're carrying. And also, I think the history is a little bit more complex than he believes, because, you know, there's these traveler's exceptions about concealed carry, and there's historical advertisements, which I like to look at, which showed that, yeah, actually concealed carry was a thing, even if it was a little bit under the table. But when you had dozens of ads talking about, like, here's a pocket carry gun, well, what were they talking about, right?
Right.
So, yeah, it's going to be a fun debate, I think, and you guys can tune in on X. It'll be recorded, so you can also catch it afterwards.
When do we get to tune in?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, it's going to be Monday evening. I think it was at 6:30 we agreed on, but I'll double check. It's going to be out Monday evening. Yeah.
6:30 Pacific time?
Pacific time, yes.
Okay, excellent. Well, I am hoping to get a chance to watch that. I think it's going to be fascinating. And, you know, my take would be, and I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but, you know, you look back at even like the Heller decision, the Supreme Court has said, sure, there may have been a time when pistols were, you know, considered dangerous and unusual. But now they are by far the most, you know, popular and common firearm for self-defense. They're protected by the Second Amendment. To me, you could argue that that same, you know, justification for concealed carry. Like, sure, at one point in time, concealed carry may not have been the standard. Open carry was. And maybe concealed carry was considered dangerous and unusual. But today it is the standard. Unquestionably, it is the standard, right? So why wouldn't concealed carry be protected by the Second Amendment just as open carry is?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And also, you know, maybe we could test this if some state, not that I'm suggesting it, but if some state wanted to ban concealed carry and mandate open carry, I get maybe it would hold up to constitutional scrutiny based on the history. But I think you have a good counterpoint, which is that just as Americans can choose which arms are protected through their choices, so too should they be able to choose the method of carry. And the plain text certainly applies. It's still bearing arms. So we're talking about history now. But to Mr. Nichols's credit, there are a lot of 19th century cases saying what he says, which is that only open carry is protected. You know, several state courts ruled that way. So he definitely has a lot of history on his side. It's going to be an interesting discussion, because I think you could look at it both ways and come to a reasonable conclusion. So,
well, as a moral degenerate who carries, I'm
me
looking
too
forward to seeing that debate.
Well, he does exempt women. I want to note that. I'm gonna push him on that too. He says it's okay for women to conceal carry, but not men. So,
no. What if you identify as a woman?
Whoa, I think we're getting to, that's above that'll be for the next debate or some other debate, somebody more qualified.
Well, listen, Kostas, as always, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's always a fun opportunity to converse with you. And again, you know, you talk about Charles Nichols being knowledgeable. I think you're one of the most knowledgeable Second Amendment guys I know.
I appreciate that.
Absolutely. And fingers crossed we get some good news on Monday from the Supreme Court orders.
It'll probably be another stay of execution, but we'll see.
I mean, listen, as you said before, when it comes to like Duncan versus Bonner, a stay is good news in its own right. I mean, anything other than a denial, which would put Duncan, you know, enforceable, including the folks who currently own these 10 plus round magazines. Yeah, a stay is a win as far as I'm concerned. If they're waiting for the Third Circuit to come out with its decision to have this formal circuit court split, okay. But yeah, just keep these other cases on hold at the very least until then.
Absolutely agreed. And Cam, thanks again for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Costas Morris joining us from the Second Amendment Foundation here on Variant Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks once again to Costas for joining on the program. Looking forward to having him back here again before long. And, you know, who knows, maybe we'll have Costas on next Monday. The Supreme Court is meeting in conference on Friday, and there are a number of Second Amendment cases that they are slated to discuss, including the five lawsuits dealing with gun and magazine bans. And then you've got some other cases as well. Schoenthal versus Raul, which is the challenge to Illinois' ban on concealed carry on public transportation. That, I believe, is being heard in conference for the first time this Friday. So fingers crossed we get another cert, more than one, from the Supreme Court when the orders come out on Monday. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, which I got to tell you, so this is not a true recidivist report. As far as I know, these individuals, first-time offenders, but this is one of those cases where the sentence just seems so egregiously light that you wonder what the heck is going on here. And I got to tell you, this is a disturbing story, particularly if you are animal lovers. The headline: Connecticut woman gets probation on charges tied to home where 100 plus dead animals were found. And it is, I mean, the story is as bad as the headline indicates. 59-year-old Jennifer Krause appeared in court on Monday this week in Connecticut. A judge sentenced her to 11 months in jail, all of which were suspended, as well as 3 years of probation after Krause took a plea bargain and pled guilty to three counts of animal cruelty. A co-defendant in this case, John Krause, I believe is her husband, took a similar plea deal back in November. He was given a 364-day jail sentence, which was immediately suspended, as well as 18 months of conditional discharges. The couple arrested by police in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, after investigators were contacted in September of 2024 by a resident near the home where this couple had apparently been living. They had been renting out the home. They hadn't been there, though, for almost a year at that point. And the homeowners were in the process of evicting the Krauses, even though, again, apparently they were not there in the home at the time. The neighbor told authorities that Jennifer Krause could be seen stopping by a few times a week to feed animals. She often had to use a flashlight because there was apparently no power to the home. So an officer responded to the home, initially wasn't able to see any animals inside. The officer was also unable to get in touch with the couple. So then in December, the next month, authorities returned to the home after the owner said they were able to carry out the eviction process. And this is just where it gets so disturbing. According to the Hartford Courant, multiple officers reported having to step over about 8 inches of trash and feces to get into the porch area, where they immediately realized that they were also stepping over dead animals that were believed to be rabbits. I'm not going to get into all of the details of the Hartford Courant reports, because frankly, I don't want to talk about it. But let's just say, authorities found a total of 105 dead animals in this home. 77 rabbits, 23 chickens, 2 cats, a duck, a skunk, and a squirrel. There was also a live skunk that appeared. The officer said it appeared to crave human contact. It was coaxed onto the front porch, where police said it immediately began looking for food and ate nearly an entire pumpkin. The skunk did not display any aggressive behavior, so the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection actually allowed the animal to roam off to freedom. There were evidence that a lot of these animals were in cages, that they had died trying to escape or after trying to escape their cages. I mean, this was just brutal stuff. And the fact that the Krauses were able to get away with probation, it is just amazing to me. They were, again, arrested, charged with cruelty to animals, first-degree criminal mischief. Apparently, their daughter was arrested as well. Her case, I guess, is still pending, but the Hartford Courant says that it has been ordered sealed by a judge which can be done in cases when a defendant applies for diversionary program. So it is entirely possible that despite the abject cruelty shown to these animals, that none of the adults responsible are going to spend any time at all behind bars. Now, Jennifer Krause is 59. Her husband, I believe, is now 70, maybe 71. I don't care, frankly, if their age mitigates this. If there is evidence of mental illness, then they need to be in a psychiatric facility. They don't need to be out on probation. Even if the probation, entails not owning any pets or animals, this is just some sick behavior. And the fact that prosecutors offered a plea deal, despite, again, the massive amount of evidence towards animal cruelty, I think is reprehensible. The fact that a judge went along with this deal and sentenced the Krauses to nothing more than suspended jail terms and a couple of years of probation, I think is inexplicable. I'm just beside myself, honestly. The cruelty, the lack of care and concern on display here is just absolutely horrific. And I don't think justice was done. Now, on to today's armed citizen story from Indianapolis, Indiana, where witnesses say a shooting that left a 21-year-old dead was justified, that 21-year-old was actually the initial aggressor in this case and was firing at multiple people. This was over the weekend, Friday night, I guess, around 8 p.m. According to Fox 59 in Indianapolis, a fight had broken out in the street near 32nd and Central Avenue. And according to witnesses, one of the individuals involved in this fight went to his car, grabbed a gun, and fired the first shots. 21-year-old Caleb Evans, that individual. One witness said, I dove on the ground and he opened fire. And at that point, I saw the guy that was standing next to me get shot, and he took off running. Fox 59 says the shooting left Evans dead on the scene. The second victim was wounded and rushed to the hospital. But a second witness told Fox 59, the guy that got shot that's in the hospital now, he saved all of us. That boy, Evans, he said, that came out, he left, came back, got in his car, came out of his car with a pistol, and started shooting at everybody. And the individual who, again, was shot and wounded was able to return fire. Fox 59 says multiple witnesses say that the surviving victim had every right to return fire, defending himself and others. One neighbor said if it wasn't for him, we probably would all be dead. I'm sorry, they said that he got shot as well, but he protected us. And if it wasn't for him, we would all be dead. Now, police have not officially determined that Evans was killed in an act of self-defense in defense of others. No arrests have been made in this case. But it does sound, again, like based on just the accounts of multiple eyewitnesses, this will likely be a justified shooting. Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department Captain Don Wheelhammer said in general response to this incident and others, he said, solving things by violence is not the solution. It's much better to try to work it out by talking. And if that's not working, turn and walk away. Okay, but if somebody grabs a gun from their car and starts shooting, at that point, you can't walk away. I'm a big believer in de-escalation whenever possible. And yes, if somebody begins threatening you and you have the opportunity to leave, get yourself away from that situation, absolutely do that. But it doesn't sound like that was possible in this circumstance. And if a guy starts shooting, not in self-defense, but as the initial aggressor, I want somebody there to be able to shoot back. And it sounds like that's what happened here. So we will keep our eyes open for any more details on this case. But again, right now, no arrests have been made. And based on the multiple accounts of eyewitnesses, it sounds like the perpetrator of this violence was shot and killed by an armed citizen in self-defense and defense of others. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. It's become sort of a trend here to talk about on the Variant Arms Cam and Company, a overturned vehicle in water and good Samaritans coming to the aid of those trapped inside. Yesterday, we talked about a case out of Florida where a couple of sailors from Pensacola Naval Air Station able to save an individual who had a medical emergency, drove off into water, was, I think, one of the sailors able to break through the sunroof and pull that individual up to safety. Today's story comes from Harrison County, Mississippi, where Good Samaritans were able to save three teenagers who were trapped upside down in standing water after their car was actually forced off the road. This wasn't a medical emergency. It sounds like this was the result of an aggressive driver, and these teens ended up leaving the road and upside down in a culvert. WLOX in Mississippi said that at least a dozen Good Samaritans stopped to help those individuals inside. J.D. Durant was one of them. He was with his adult son and a coworker driving in a car when they saw this Chevy Impala get forced off of I-10. It flipped multiple times, and then it landed upside down in a culvert. Durant told WLOX, when it started flipping like it did, I was afraid we were in for some hard times. Missy Pearson, who is Durant's coworker, said, we pulled over, and I could see the children. They're crying and saying, help me, help me. So they're upside down in this ditch. This photo from WLOX, you can see the vehicle there. Thankfully, not completely submerged. But at that point, you got to worry about, you know, the injuries from a car flipping over multiple times and then ending up down in this culvert. Bay High senior Mariah Gill, her two younger brothers, were inside the vehicle. She said she remembers hearing her brothers' cries for help as the water began filling that sedan as they're upside down. She said, I could hear my brother screaming, water's coming in, and trying to kick something open. J.D. Durant's son, James, was the first to get into the water. His dad says he exhibited, quote, superhero-like strength and managed to pull one of the car doors open to rescue the teenagers inside. Gill's brothers were the first to get extricated from the car. She said she was relieved when she realized that there were people rushing to their aid. Eventually, J.D. Durant says 10 to 15 people had pulled off to the side of the road. He says everybody was in the water. He said, I hollered for help. There were five men right there helping us to get the young lady out of the water. You know, so many times when we talk about these Hero of the Day stories, it is, you know, a lone Good Samaritan, maybe one or two Good Samaritans, and other people are driving by. They see what's going on, and for whatever reason, they don't stop. This is one of the first incidents that I can recall where, again, it seemed like a majority of the people who were aware of what was going on did pull over, did stop to help, and were able to save these lives. Now, according to WLOX, before the crash, the teens and other witnesses say a red Kia Soul was weaving in and out of traffic and actually forced Gill off the road and then sped away. One witness said she tried chasing after the Soul, but it was going too fast for them to catch up. I didn't realize Kia Souls could go that fast, quite frankly. But police are investigating. They do have an image of the vehicle in question. Authorities actually pulled a photo of the suspect vehicle from security camera footage. And hopefully they're going to be able to make an arrest in this case, because this was not just, you know, again, a driver suffering from a medical emergency or mistaking the gas pedal for the brake. This was something that could have been prevented. I don't know if it was entirely intentional or not, just somebody being a jackass behind the wheel. But thankfully, again, there were a number of Good Samaritans there in Mississippi who were able to save the lives of these three teens. So in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing, teaching every one of those Good Samaritans, we thank you for your very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company, and I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. If you like what you see, again, I would encourage you to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And again, if you like what you see, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. You'll get great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose. If you are a VIP Gold and Platinum member, you get to take part, for instance, in our live chats every week. We do this Wednesdays today at 1:30 Eastern. Hot Air's Ed Morrissey and myself hanging out with our VIP Gold and Platinum friends for about an hour, talking about the news of the day, whatever you want to talk about. It's a great time. One of my favorite hours of the work week, quite frankly, and I would love for you to be a part of it. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT. And you can take 60% off your membership, no matter what tier of support you choose. And no matter what tier you choose, you'll be supporting the work that we're doing at Bearing Arms. So thank you very much for that, truly. Have a great rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. The weekend is in sight. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.